Okay, so we're going to do one of. It's just one of my favorite Gemaras with one of my favorite personalities in Gemara. Aburiya is just such a wonderful personality. There's so many things you could do every time you read her any story with her in Shas. I really, that whole family friend teacher Rebbe structure is fascinating. I mean, you think about Aburiya, right? Her father is Rav Chanina ben Tradyon, right? Her husband is Rebbe Meir, right? The way I tend to think of this whole family structure is that, what does the Gemara say about Rebbe Meir? That we never paskin like Rebbe Meir. Why? No, that's not what the Gemara says. It's because he was too smart and could explain both sides so well that no one ever knew how to paskin, right? So Rebbe Meir is the Tana that no one ever stood, right? Buria is the Tana who could never be, right? Acher is the Tana who went bad, right? The whole structure there, I just love it. I mean, everything about it is, I love it. It's wonderful. There's nothing about it. We can't try passing like Acher. Buria has such an amazingly sharp tongue. I mean, yeah. So she's always fun. I mean, every time you meet Buria, she is just so much fun. I mean, this is not even the most fun. I mean, in my opinion, the Gemara in Erevin with Rabbi Yossi Haglili is just so much fun, right? Oh, that's a great story just to get our personalities going. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Well, no, you gotta actually. That's not doing justice to what she says. Right, Rabbi Yossi Haglili comes over to her and says, right, please tell me how we go to Lud. He asks for directions. And she turns to him and says, Gliloi tapshoi, right, you idiot Galilean. Amru chachamim al tarbe sicha im ha'isha. Right, Chazal said, don't talk too much to women. You should have said, Eze lilud, right? It's a wonderful little story. That is the entire story. The wonderful little story. What she's doing in that is fascinating. Who knows what she's doing? The simplest shot in that story, I tend to think, is what Ray Clapper once told me, which was her problem. What she wasn't actually. The Rashbats actually thinks the lesson of this story is that you're not allowed to say extra words to women. He actually does think that. But the simple shot is not that she said extra words. It's what words she said. And there was a word in there that was very problematic. And that was we, right? Rabbi Yossi clearly went over to someone else's wife and she wasn't going to Lud and said, which way do we go to Lud? And she says, excuse me, right? Right? Which is probably the actual shot of that story, right? Anyways, Bria is wonderful. So Brachot Daf Yud, you get some of these unbelievable stories. So I'm going to focus on the first one. I know that Reis Sklar did Rav Kook on this story, so I'm just going to leave Rav Kook out of it. So what happens? Hanu biryone dahave b'shivivute de Rebbe Meir. Yud Aleph. So there were ruffians. That's a good word. I have here the Koren one pulled up. They have hooligans. Also a good word. Also words I don't use. Sure, whatever. But hooligans, ruffians that were in the community of Rabbi Meir. Vahave kumitsaro le tuva. And they drove him crazy. So have ko bai Rabbi Meir rachme ilavayu kehecha dilemetu. So he davened for to have mercy that they should die. Amrule Buria dibitsu. So Buria, his wife, said, my daitoch, what are you thinking? Mishum dichtiv yitamu chataim. Are you telling me that, are you making a drasha on the pasuk in Tehillim, in Baruch Nafshi, which says, Yitamu chataim in aret rishoim ein einam, od einam, right? Let chataim, whatever that word means, cease from the land and evil shall be no more. Michtev chotim, are you reading it as chotim, sinners? Chataim ktiv. It says chataim, which might mean sins. It might not. We'll get to the grammatical point in a minute. Va'od Furthermore, Shvil is Seifei Dikra. Go to the end of the Gemara. Urishaim Ud Einam. The Pasuk says that if they die, right, if they cease, there will be no more evil people. Kevandi Tamu Chataim Urishaim Ud Einam. What? Some bad people die and now there's no more evil? Eloboy Rachame Ilavayu. Davin for them Dilahadru Bitshuva. They should repent. Urishaim Ud Einam. And then there will be no evil because there will only be good. Ba rachame ilavaihu v'hadaro b'tshuva. So he agreed and he davened and they did tshuva. Okay? I just want to focus on this story. Wonderful story. I love it. Okay? On top of Yonam Alev. Now, there are so many parts to this story that need to be tackled. I don't know how many we'll get through today. But if we pick it apart line by line, there's a lot to do here. Okay, before I tell you what I want to deal with, you tell me what goes on in this story. Hello, Yotam, how are you? Wonderful. So good to see you. Always, always. Okay, what questions do you have in this story?
Why didn't he just break down and teach
you? Okay, fine. What was Reb Meir thinking? Great. Why didn't he do that originally? Good. What else? Okay, how is he getting annoyed, right? What's going on? What's so bad? Okay, what else? Sure, does that work, right? Why would you ask me that? Or is it the right thing to do, like on Daf Zion, where we say people shouldn't be punished to the view, right? We had that case, right, where he tried to channel the moment of God's wrath, right? And they said, that's not what we do. We're not supposed to do that. Good, what else? How many grammarians do I have?
I like grammar.
Good. So ask me the grammatical question everyone, starting with the Rishonim, asked.
Say the thing about
right, the drasha is, she says to him, Michtiv, Chotim, Chataim, Ktiv, which most people read. Does it say sinners? It says sins. What's the problem? Very good. Chataim means sinners. Very good. Thank you. Chataim means sinners. It does not mean sins. What? Well, we'll get to that. But chataim probably does not mean sins, right? It probably means sinners, right? So much so, as we will talk about in a minute, Rashi, Ki'ilu, and all of Mefarshim, basically, in their Perush on Tehillim, interpret this word as sinners, not sin, right? They do not paskin, as it were, like Buria. So much so that the Munkacher actually says, yes, the lesson of this story is that women, Nashim, died to Kalanhan, we don't paskin like women, which is not the message of this story, but unbelievably, that's actually what he does. Wow. Yeah, when I read that, when I first heard that, I'm like, wow, that was an interesting read of that story. He even points to a second Gemara, right? There is a parallel Gemara in which Abba Chilkiah's wife does the same thing, right? In Tainit Chav Gimel, where Abba Chilkiah's wife davens, tells him to daven from Tshuva, he wants them to die. And again, Abba Chilkiah acknowledges that she's right. So he just says, you see, it's always women who are saying this. I'm like, okay, that is a really bad parish in both of those stories. Rav Asher Weiss has a Tshuva where he says, B'michilat kvod Torato, that is so not the point of these stories. A Tshuva, mind you. Okay, but there's the grammatical issue. What is what is the grammar here? Then there's some deep philosophical questions that people ask.
How can you pray for someone?
Good, why not? Okay, one is how do you can daven for the jai? What's the other one? Oh, good, how can you daven for someone to tshuva? Why? Yeah, thank you. It's a good thing to do parshat bo, you know, free will, that thing that we've heard of that, you know, people do. What exactly is going to happen here? Right? This is what everyone asks. Now, in terms of Rishayim dying, right, so you'd say, well, how can we do that? Well, some of the Mefarshim ask that question here, and some of them ask it somewhere else. You know where they ask it? Because let's say Buria is right. There's a slight kasha. Slight kasha, what? Well, no, there's a slight kasha that you only interact with three times a day. Oh, those evil people, they should have no hope. They should be lost. They could be destroyed, right? So every line in this Gemara, wait. Are you allowed to daven for people to die? Are you allowed to daven for them to do tshuva? Isn't that taking away free will? There is so much going on in this Gemara. It's just wonderful. Okay? Good. So much fun. It was so much fun to prepare this. I love this story. I really do. Okay. I also have a wonderful quote by C.S. Lewis that I do have to share, but the question is, do I wait till the end, or should I start with a C.S. Lewis quote? No, okay. We'll leave it. Fine. Oh, so, okay. No, I promised, before we start answering the questions, I'm going to do a little bit of Girsa work, because I promised Josh I would do a little bit of Girsa work on this story, okay? But, yeah, manuscripts. But I know that manuscripts can sometimes be boring, but in this case, I actually found it to be very, very interesting. So I came across an article yesterday, a few days ago, on this story by, I don't know, okay, from someone at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. Interesting. Okay. But where she pointed to these Girsa things, and I think she's right to notice them. What's her name? Mira Beth Wasserman. Okay. What? Sure. But she notes that if you go to the manuscripts, you actually, before we can answer the question of the story, you can dramatize it even more. Because as we have it in our Girsa, so what did Rabbi Meir want to do? How? He wanted to daven, right? He wanted to daven that they should die. So it's basically a local machloket between Meir and his wife, where Meir wants to daven for them to die, and Bria says, no, you should daven for them to do tshuva, right? But here's how it appears in the Munich manuscript and the Paris, what? Very. These are very old, right? These are all very classic manuscripts, okay? So I'll read it, and we'll right, look at your Gemara and watch the changes, okay? So first I'll read you Munich 95, okay? Hanu birione dahavu bishivivute di Rebbe Meir. So far, pretty much the same. Good. Vahavu kemitzare le tuva. The same? Yeah. Shamtinhu. What does that mean? He put them in cherem, in shamta, right? It's a type of excommunication, right? Wait. Ba'u le'avdinhu. He wanted to kill them.
Oh, wow.
Right? Okay. Right? Alayhu racham egechi delamitzu. Now, okay, now I'm going to read you the Paris manuscript, okay? Havu biryone dahave bishivivuta diri meir bahave kumitsare leituva. Same. Almost. Shamtinhu. They put him in cherem, or shamta. Ba'u le'ovdinhu. Now, in the Munich manuscript, it said, alayhu rachame, which sounds like he wanted to kill them, maybe via tefillah, maybe, not totally clear, right? Again, Paris manuscript, Shamtinu boy loved inhu. He put him in cherem and wanted to kill them. Amra le Buria de Bitsu. Right? Right, so, okay. Oxford, 366. Hanu biryone de havu maybe, bishivivuti de remeir. Great? All right, so this is pretty much the same. Havu boy mirmer rachmei alayu de levedu. Okay, similar. Bologna, the city, right? Hanach biryoni davi shivuti dere meir dahavu kamitzaran leituva vekebe rabbe racha rachme alayu. Didn't know this is the same. The main ones, though, are really Munich and Paris. In Munich, right, and so in this article, she points out very nicely that this is a very different story, right? The story as it appears in our manuscript, and to be fair, in Oxford and in Bologna and some of the others, is that this is about, we're going to leave it up to God. The question is, what are we going to ask God to do? Are we going to ask God to kill them? Or are we going to ask God to help them repent? In which case, the message of the story is very personal. What is the proper way for an individual to relate to people who are bothering him, to evil people, v'chulei, right? That's what this is.
It seems like it would sound different to the proper
Well, that's a very nice story. In the Munich, and even more so in the Paris manuscript, that is not the story. The story goes like this. Rabbi Meir says, I would like to shoot them, and I am going to use the court system to do it if they don't stop bothering me. He had already excommunicated them, and he was going to kill them, right? Berea says, honey, I think you, not personally, I'm just saying you, in your political role as someone who is capable of, you know, excommunicating people and putting them to death, you may be overreacting just a little bit. Maybe you should take a different approach. The question of whether this is Berea talking to Rabbi Meir qua her husband, or Rabbi Meir as in, listen, you know, I think this might be political power that has gone a little bit amok. I think you are misthinking this. You know, don't.
I'm just imagining the mouth of a
laughter. Right? I do think she is right, that you cannot, if you see these manuscripts, suddenly the story is like, you know, the drama is quite heightened if it isn't between davening for God to take care of them by killing them or God to take care of it by making them do tshuva. But if the choices are between davening for them to do tshuva and using the powers of the court to put them to death. Those are, you know, when she says, honey, you know, I have to teach you, I have to give you a shear that might reorient the way you think. Again, how heated this dispute may be getting probably depends on whether you think the option in hand was prayer or a gun, right? You know. So I do think that in this particular, right, sometimes manuscript work, you're like, okay, that's very interesting. Sometimes you're like, okay, that really does change the story, right? That really, I mean, really changes the story. It also, of course, forces you to ask, what exactly were these people doing, right? Meaning, there's one thing to say, they're bothering me, God help me by killing them. It's a different thing to say, you are so annoying, right? If all they were doing is annoying you, you might think that he probably wouldn't use the power of the judicial system to kill them. You might think. Ah, that's the proper way to think. But what if, you know, there's annoying and then there's annoying. Yeah, thank you, Mordechai. Clearly, that's... What? Okay. We'll see. I don't know. What? Okay. Fine. So, but I do think that was, when I saw that, I'm like, okay, you know, okay, fair enough. That really adds to the story. Okay, so now that we have the proper drama set up in the story, let's try to understand what's going on. First, let's start from the minor point here. Let's start with the grammatical point. Everyone reads the Sinner and says, reads the Gemara and says, Rabbi Meir says one thing, and Berea says, listen, it doesn't say sinner, it says sin. As all the Rishonim say, no, it doesn't, right? No, it doesn't. The Tosfot Rashi says, V'afal chataim k'tiv. I will read you the Tosfot Rashi. This is not something like modernish. Or the Tosfot Rashi says, V'afal gav dahainu namu chotem bivav. That is the same thing as chotem with a vav. Right? It means sinner, right? Dehalo karinan chataim bechatav patach. Right? Because she's, right? What would sins be? Right? Chataim would be, if it was chait, it was sins, it would be with a chata fatach, right? I don't want to get into the grammar right now. You guys don't even know what a chata fatach is, right? Chata fatach is the equivalent of a shva.
Yeah. Like,
correct. But you read it as a patach, correct. It's the grammatical equivalent of a, yeah, anyways. Mikol makom, so he just says mikol makom. He deshane kray b'dibure veloktiv chotim bivav yesh ledarsha lashon avonot. He says, okay, but it doesn't have a vav, so you can make a drasha. That's her point. Her point is not this is pshat. Now this is a very important point because what is according to the Rosh, what is Berea saying? What is she not saying? The way most people read it is, Berea is saying you're wrong, right? You think that it's proper to let sinners die. It's the pasuk doesn't say sinners, it says sin, right? According to the Rosh, she's not saying that. What is she saying the pshat is? Sinner. But she's saying, but there's another meaning. So what is she really doing?
You don't have to go for the extreme.
Exactly. You don't have to go that way. Right? That's a very different argument. Right? Saying that you're wrong is different than saying, listen, I'm not saying that's not possible. I'm just saying there's another option here. Right? That's a very different story. Right? Now, obviously, if you go back to what we said before, if it's just about davening and davening, that's one thing. If she's saying there's another way out rather than...
You don't need to actually tell them.
Right? You know, that's, you know, it's amazing that he actually listens. Okay? The Yaivetz gets more detailed. He says, Chataim karinan bepatach v'tet digusha. Okay? So here's how it goes, okay? So here's how it goes, okay? He says, technically, okay, this is how it goes. How is the word actually read? This is going to be very grammatical. I'm sorry. Forgive me. No. Chataim. Now you're all like, what in God's name did I just say that was different than what he said? What? Exactly. It's a dagesh. There's a dagesh chazak in the tet. Right? And therefore, right, it is, right, patach, not a chataf patach, right, with a tet digusha. Right? But since it could be read chataim, chataim would be sins, but chataim is sinners, right?
That's not great.
What? So, no, what she's saying is since you could read it that way, v'yesh l'dar shalakan, v'yesh l'dar shalakan, right? Okay? And therefore, what she was saying is you should daven that the, okay, and if you go through many of the grammarians, they will, in different ways, right, note versions of this. Okay? Now, as many people point out, let's cover the grammatical point. Now, can you think of another word where it's clear that something like chataim really does mean sinners and not sin? I'm sure you can. How about ganavim? Thieves? Ganavim. Ganavim. Not anavim. Ganavim. Ganavim are thieves. Right? You ever heard that word? A ganav? Right? Yeah, a ganav. A ganav. Okay? A ganav. Right? Is a... And in fact, Rashi and the Pasuk, as I said, says the symbol pshat is... sinners, right? That's what he says, right? Meaning it really does mean sinners, as everybody here says, right? Everybody thinks that that the grammar really does, right? Really does mean that.
Wouldn't it say if it's saying that, like, you don't have to do this option?
Okay, well, wait a second. Let's get the grammatical point, and then let's come back to what she's saying, okay? Right? And again, the Marsha says... The same thing. The chotim of Shem Torah, but chotim mashra gam Shem Torah. Right? He's saying it means both sinner, right? Depending how you read it, and sin. Mashra nami Shem Torah shachotim rabim. Vamrei bria michtiv chotim de lo mashra Shem Torah. Right? The Marsha says the way it goes is it didn't say chotim, which only means sinner. It said chotim, which could mean, right? Which is ambiguous, right? Right, and again, if you read it without the vowels, maybe you could read it as chotim, right? Or you read it with the right, without the dagesh and the chatapatach, so it means whatever. Okay. As I said, right, one way of looking at this is the Minchas Elazar, where the Minchas Elazar just says, no, she's just wrong. She's making up a bad grammar, and Nashim Daitzos Kal is saying that we don't fasten like Buria, and the right thing to do is to daven for Hashem to die, and yalla, end of story. Okay. And like I said, Rav Asher Weiss, right? Now, what some people point out is maybe that's not what she's saying. Okay? Maybe that's not the argument she's making. Maybe even grammatically she's making a different argument. It's not sinner versus sin. Okay? What's the difference between chotim, a chote, and chataim? What? I know, this is killing you. I'm gonna...
who sins really?
Someone who is sinning and sinner.
Very good. Is someone who happens to be sinning, right? I'm ochel, right? I eat, right? But, right, a ganav is not one who seems, it's a thief, right? Chataim implies repetition. It's someone who, it's part of his identity, right? So some suggest that what she's saying is, no, not chataim versus chotim. It's chotim versus chataim. It doesn't say someone who happens to be sinning.
You only kill the people that are constantly.
Exactly, you only kill the people who are chataim. Right? Right? Who are defined by their sin. Right? Oh, no. One second. We're not killing them unless you're in the Paris manuscript. If you're in the Paris manuscript. No, in a Hanami. Now, grammatically, that might solve the problem. Right? But why would you say that? Because that solves some of the problems like Vilam Malshinim. Right? If you want to get the Vilam Malshinim problem, you could say, what do you mean? Berea also says that sinners should die.
And you're not,
right?
And also gets rid of the problem of why can you stop and for somebody to do shiva? Gets rid of that deal.
Potentially. Okay, so, but this is the grammatical issue, okay? I don't want to get too bogged down in it, but you should understand that the grammatical issue is more complicated than it appears in the way most people present it, okay? But I want to ask you first. Again, this will probably take us more than 1 week because there's so much packed in this story. There's the theological implication. There's so much here. And I was like, should I give them Makaros? No, let's talk about it as we go. So, okay, but now, based on what we've just said about the grammar, someone explain to me, what is she doing? Explain to me, relationship-wise, pastorally, like, what is she doing? So, right, what you realize is that there's a lot actually hangs on what you think is going on here grammatically, right? If you think she's saying you're wrong, right? So then what she's saying, right, then what she's saying is, right, you're wrong, right? You're taking the approach, and that is the wrong approach. But if she's saying that there's another approach, right, I can come up with a drasha, she's not saying you're wrong. She's saying that wasn't the only option, and I'm suggesting that's not the right option. It's not that it's not, right? It's not that what you're saying doesn't have merit, right? But it's not ideally what you should do, right? There is another way of, right? You can think, to put it poetically, right? If you think creatively enough in the psukim, there's another way to think about this, right? Meaning, maybe that's not pshat, but if you think creatively, there's another way you could come out with. Now, at some level, I think that's true. What else is she doing? And I don't want you to overthink this. I want you to think very simply. What is she doing? Good. And how is she doing that? I understand. There is a certain logic to what she's doing outside of the drasha. What is she doing? And how is she doing that? How is she getting to think? Now, how is she getting to think? How is she getting to think? Come on. No. What is she doing? Come on. And therefore. Imagine the scene, right? Think of, very good, right? Have you ever seen a very angry, right? Imagine a very, very angry Talmud Chacham, right? Sometimes, what's the best way to cool them down? I have a vort. I have a chiddush. It's like, woo, right? 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 No, but I think at some level, think about it, right? Meaning, whether or not it's the right drasha, I mean, think about it. She is, as we said, the Tana who could never be, right? The, as it were, right? But your her husband is Rabbi Meir. He is the, right, smartest of the smartest, we've already said. And he, right, but really smart people sometimes also get angry, get caught up, right? What do you need to do? You need to shift them out of their angry mode, of their emotional mode, right? And get them back at their normal, thoughtful, let's think this through. Don't be hasty. Sometimes the Talmud Chacham, what's the best way of doing that? Yes, it's like, honey, I've got a great, right? Because if she had just said to him, calm down. I don't want to calm down, right? They're so annoying. As Mordechai said, some people are just so annoying, they deserve to die. She says, honey, that's not what I want to do. I want to learn with you. I have a chiddush. Oh, a chiddush. Oh, a chiddush. Okay, this can wait. What? Bus? Yes, next time I get angry. We have a chiddush. Save your chiddush. I have a chiddush. Right? Right? Oh, but then you, right, but one, but if you say that what she's doing, it doesn't need to be pshat, right? She's saying a drasha. What is she doing? She's using Torah. She's using classic methodology to engage him in thought because, right, to use modern psychology, right? How many of you have actually got around to reading Thinking Fast and Slow?
No, but the Bible
doesn't mean that we are so slow. That's ironic. Okay, very in brief. Okay, Thinking Fast and Slow was written by two originally Israeli psychologists. Both, it's very, you know, very interesting. Both of them are from very big rabbinic families, though neither of them were religious themselves. Which is always fun to see the two sides of the family. So one of them won the Nobel Prize. The other one didn't, only because he had already passed away, and you can't win the Nobel Prize posthumously. You cannot be awarded the Nobel Prize posthumously. And by time, so anyway, it's written by Daniel Kahneman, right, and Amos Tversky. Okay. What? They're both very rabbinic families, and also Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize for the. Yeah, Tversky is a very rabbinic family, and so is Kahneman, right? Kahneman, his uncle, was the Rosh Yeshiva Panovich, Rev Kahneman, right? And yes, the Tverskys are a Hasidish dynasty, yes. So they were two Israeli psychologists who won the Nobel Prize in economics and for revolutionizing the way we think, essentially. But one of their main contributions in that book is what is known. So who actually, it's been passed around, so who's reading it? None of you have read it. Oh, God. Okay, so Kahneman and Tversky introduced the notion of System 1, System 2. And it's very complicated, very formal jargon here. System 1, System 2. What are System 1 and System 2? Did none of you have read? Wait, okay, it's being passed around. You haven't gotten yet, so who?
I don't know. It kind of just like faded into obscurity.
I promise you it didn't go into obscurity. They literally won the Nobel Prize for it.
Here,
in fact, not only do they go to the Nobel Prize for it, but several Nobel Prizes have been awarded since then of people who built on that work, including Richard Thaler in 2018. Also, totally worth reading Thaler. Oh, you should have clarified. Oh, totally worth reading Fast and Slow. Also worth reading Thaler's work, which built on it. Which one? Nudge, Misbehaving. Nudge is the more famous one. Misbehaving is more fun. Yeah, it really is fun. Geschmack. So System 1 is the fast, automatic, frequent, emotional, stereotypic, unconscious. Okay? System 2 is slow, effortful, infrequent, logical, calculating, conscious. But these are the two ways that we think. System 1, System 2. And right, basically they talk about System 1 are the things that we do without thinking, where we rely on intuition or heuristics, right? Things like, right, also known as biases, right? Heuristics and biases, like what they call vayasati, right? Vayasati. Vayasati. Vyasati. What you see is all there is, right? Yes, vayasati. And it's really not helpful, but that's what they write it, right? But System 1... and often System 1 works well, except when it doesn't, right? And that System 1, which helps us a lot, right? A lot of things in life, you don't want to have to think, right? Heuristics are very helpful, right? Like how many people want, right? I'm sure you know this, right? I mean, when you're driving, you don't want to be using System 2, right? If you wait to analyze, right, you see something swerving at you, right? You want it to be second nature, right? That's how we drive, right? System one is very important. But sometimes we get caught up in system ones, like biases, right? It's important. It's important to be able to stop ourselves so that we can engage system two, okay? So it could be that what she's doing is, doesn't matter whether Josh is real, what she's doing, right? She's getting him to engage system two. They've done studies that it takes very little to, if you can do the slightest thing to engage system two, it will improve your understanding and analysis. So for example, one of the fascinating studies they did is that if you want to make sure that people will think more about something and analyze it deeper, one of the things you can do is print it in smaller or less clear font. Because the second your brain, if it's big and clear, your brain, right, you aren't forced to analyze it. And what they've shown is that once you start engaging your mind for any reason, right, even if it's not related, right, you're squinting. But the second you do that, it shifts the way you think. Of course, I've read the study appears in several books, but I read it in Thinking Fast and Slow, but I also read it once in Dan Ariely's books. Dan Ariely is another Israeli psychologist who's popularized a lot of this type of thinking. He's a lot of fun. All his books are fun. Josh Gutenberg was the one who introduced him to me, and then I read all his books. Irrationally Yours. Well, that was for Shlomo. It's a friend of mine from Gush, but he lives in Toronto. Irrationally Yours, Predictably Irrational, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, Payday, Dollars and Cents. He's so much fun. But it was funny. At some point, I read this. I was reading this. He was writing about this study. So I was going on my binge reading of everything Dan Ariely. And the problem was that one of the books, it didn't happen to have it in the library in the normal font. What they did have was the font for the people who are near blind, right? The one where it's like each thing is like font 600. So in the original book, right, it was printed smaller to illustrate this experiment, to show you how it would work in your own brain. But they didn't, whoever was changing it didn't notice this. So instead, it was all the same font. And like, it's like, look, this word is smaller. I'm like, not in the version that I am currently reading. By the way, for the record, this is the type of thing that you have to be very careful about, because sometimes it makes a difference. Like in this book, it made a difference, but there are famous cases in halacha where this also made a difference. So for example, in some of the classic Nida Svarim, right? The size that a blood stain is metame is called a gris. And in many of the classic Nida Svarim, they drew the size of it and said it's this big. And then the printer didn't realize and published the mini size version, and suddenly you had all types of chumras because it shrunk with it, right? So sometimes you really got to be careful about things like that. This is one of those famous cases in halacha. So it could just be, coming back to our story, that what she's trying to do is just engage him in system two, right? If you get them to stop and think, right, then you shift people out of system one, right, into system two, right? And then the way we approach things in system two is fundamentally different. So, right, so I think methodologically what she's doing is, whether she's saying you're wrong or she's saying there's another way to think about it, what's the main point of what she's doing? Stopping him by getting him to think, right? That's what she's doing, right? And that, I think, is a very powerful move, okay? And then he ends up buying it. Okay, you know what? I think I will redo the C.S. Lewis quote, because this is lighter, before I get to some of the harder parts of this. Okay, I came across in Mere Christianity, that's the name of the book. I'm not converting. This was just the name of the book. So many traditions have some version of the sin-sinner thing, right? Love the sin. Love the sin. Love the sinner, hate the sin. Yeah, now I'm going to be quoted. He said, love the sin. No, I didn't say that. I mean, I did say that. I didn't mean it. Mistake. Freudian slip. Fine, okay. Yes. But Lewis asked a very simple question. He says, okay, let's assume I'm right. Right? You get you to system two. How? How do we do it emotionally? How do you do it?
How
do you get yourself to do that?
To do what?
To love the sinner but hate the sin. What? How do you do that? That's not exactly easy. What do you do? Not everyone is a good person. We'll see whether that's going on tomorrow. But sure, okay. So C.S. Lewis has a very nice idea, and he says, "I'm gonna get you to the key line. Okay, I'm gonna start reading it for you, and I want it's a very brilliant insight. I really like it." He says, "For a good many people, imagine that forgiving your enemies means making out that they are really not such bad fellows after all, when it is quite plain that they are." Okay, go a step further. In my most clear-sighted moments, not only do I think myself a nice man, but I know that I'm a very nasty one. I can look at some of the things I've done with horror and loathing. So apparently I'm allowed to loathe in some of the things my enemies do. Now she said, so he said, right? I remember Christian teachers telling me long ago that I must hate a bad man's actions, but not hate the bad man. Or as they would say, hate the sin, but not the sinner. For a long time, I used to think this a silly straw-splitting distinction. How could you hate what a man did and not hate the man? But years later, it occurred to me that there was one man to whom I had been doing this all my life.
Yourself.
Namely, myself. I said, myself. Said, however much I might dislike my own cowardice or conceit or greed, I went on loving myself. There had never been the slightest difficulty about it. In fact, the very reason why I hated the things was that I loved the man. Just because I loved myself, I was sorry to find that I was the sort of man who did those things. Consequently, Christianity does not want us to reduce by one atom the hatred we feel for cruelty and treachery. We ought to hate them. Not one word of what we have said about them needs to be unsaid. But it does want us to hate them in the same way in which we hate things in ourselves, being sorry that the man should have done such things and hoping, if in any way possible, that somehow, sometime, somewhere, he can be cured and made human again. I thought that was a very, very nice insight, right? Meaning, in the end, it is possible, right? And as he said, we do that to ourselves, right? When we do things that are wrong, most people don't hate themselves, right? They might feel disgusted with themselves, right? They might want to change, but they don't, right? Most people don't hate themselves because they understand that people can do bad things, right? And he argues that it's that ability to recognize in ourselves that we can distinguish between the person. And in fact, as he says, the fact that we know we can do better is what makes us hate what we do so much when we're disappointed in ourselves. So even if someone is really bad, we can hate it, but we can also have at some level this notion that I hate that you are doing it, right? Because I know that as a human being, you can do better. And at some level, you need to be able to introduce that into your calculus, which is, I don't hate you. I hate the fact that I know you could do better and you're not, and you're doing something which is despicable, right? And what makes it worse is that you're a human being who could do better. And that's what makes me angry, right? That's what makes me disappointed, right? Just like I would myself. And I thought that was, right? C.S. Lewis has this way sometimes of just making points where it's like, oh, that's a very interesting way of thinking about it. So I do think that if we go in this direction, that so far what we've built is that Beria is just trying to get him to think, to slow down, say, okay, calm down. Is this really what you want to do? Right? The answer is, right, no. Once he stops and thinks, he doesn't. Right? It's clear that he doesn't, because in the end of the day, he... Now, in this sense... Right, in this sense, right, the Munkacher's right claim seems even less likely, right? That Bria is wrong. I mean, in the end of the day, it's a very hard read. I mean, Rameyer in the end agrees. Does that mean it's the only approach? The point is, now it also happens to be that in the Zohar, in the Midrash HaNe'elam, this is presented, and the Rabbi Yeager points this out. It's not just presented as a machloket between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Between Rabbi Meir and Beria is presented as a machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemia, I think. One second, let me see. I have it up. Between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemia, right? So this notion that this is you know, Bria, because she's a woman, right? That just doesn't stand up. It's also a parallel machloket. Both in the Zohar, no, sorry. The parallel machloket is in the Midrash Tehillim, in the Shochar Tov, is between, makes it a machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemya. Right? The Gemara, the Midrash introduces it as machloket Rabbi Yehuda and Nechemya, and then says, and by the way, Rabbi Meir and Bria had the same machloket, right? So they present it as a rabbinic machloket, right? Meaning they're, which highlights the fact that this might actually be not just a rhetorical move, that there's actual truth here, right? Again, it doesn't mean it's the only way of reading it, but there's an actual machloka, whether this is an even in a legitimate way to read. And there, again, it does seem to side in favor of reading it like Breyer, at least as a preferred option. And in the Zohar, it explicitly, and this is where Mickey Hager points out, goes in the direction. What?
Nothing, you just read the Zohar.
Yes, I did.
Yes.
And? And?
Ooh. What?
What? See, this reminds me many years ago. It was, everybody responds to stress in different ways, okay? So, 11 years ago, give or take. Thank you. Oh, that's so sweet. So when I was in Rosenzweig chair, and we were learning the sugya of Yeharik Vel Yavor, and my head was elsewhere because I was getting engaged that night. What? It was a good reason. No, it was a good reason. And we were in the middle of the sugya, but what? Yes, yes, exactly. My head was elsewhere, my inhibitions might have been down just a little bit. So I probably would normally have restrained myself from doing this, but you know, as I said, my head was a little bit elsewhere. So after going through the sugya of after people going on of what exactly is the status of Karka Olam, Esther Karka Olam, and they were going over the classic lumdus, which is Yeharik Val Yavor, is it a din in the Chumras HaAvera, or a din in Kiddush Hashem, right? This is the classic lumdus, okay? I don't want to get into it. But basically, is it that the big three, right, the reason that it's Yeharik Val Yavor, it's because it's murder, or does the fact that someone's holding a gun to your head make it that you're not actually chayav for killing someone or for avodah zarah because you were an anus, you have a separate chiyuv, right? A chiyuv asay to mikadei shem shamayim, right? So the way the lumdus is if you violate when you're supposed to give up your life, if you, let's say, worship avodah zarah, what iser did you violate? Did you violate avodah zarah, right? Or did you violate, or did you fail to mikadei shem shamayim? That's the, or both. Right, that's the classic lumdus. So I, at that point, raised my hand and I said, well, the conceptual extreme of the Kiddush Hashem Shita is in the Zohar, which says that Esther Karka Olam means that Esther sent a shade who was made of dirt to impersonate her and sleep with Ahasuerosh, from which you see there was no Maisa Avera, there was only Kiddush Hashem, at which point, as you can tell, when you quote Zohar randomly in a very serious Yom Rosenzweig, you know, 95 people sort of exploded in cheer, right? And what? Now, of course, afterwards, so then, of course, what made it worse was that in the middle of cheer, the cheer assistant then sent out an angry clarifying email with regards to quoting Zohar in cheer, which was then made worse by the fact that Ora had made up an email to be on the shear list because she was following the shearim online, right? So she didn't ever get engaged, but suddenly got this angry email, didn't know what was going on in shear, right? To find out that I was the one who started this whole balagan, right? And yeah, anyways, it was a fun day. But afterwards, to be fair, afterwards, Rosenzweig and some of the top guys in Jordan agreed with me that it was a very fair lumdish point. It just happened to be from a very odd source. Meaning, not that the Zohar is a weird source. That was a very weird Zohar. But the point being that Rosenzweig said, I have no problem with you quoting Zohar. It was conceptually relevant. So, yes, I have no problem quoting Zohar if that is what you were asking, right? I know, he was laughing. Yes, I know. The Zohar. The Zohar sides with Berea. Happy?
Yes.
The Zohar sides with Berea. The point is, it's relevant. I still don't understand what you're doing. Okay? Yeah, I don't get it. Okay, so that is on the grammatical move the claim she's actually making. We're gonna come back to one more attempt of the grammatical point when it's relevant conceptually. Okay, but now let's turn to the actual substance of what's going on. Okay. So now, like I said, what are the problems? Now we've made the argument. She's convinced Rabbi Meir that the better way is to daven rather than either davening for them to do tshuva rather than either davening for them to die or convening a bezdin and having them killed. Okay? What's the problem? Right? So we said there's a few problems. Right? One problem is, there's a problem in both directions. Can you daven for someone to do tshuva? Isn't that a problem of davening for their free will to be suspended? Right? Because God...
I mean, deep down they know that they don't want to be sinning.
Okay, so you might say, not a problem. Or you might say, that's not really what the tefillah is. So you either have to say, there's no problem with suspending free will, or davening for someone to do tshuva isn't really davening for their free will to be suspended. It's something else, right? But you have to grapple with that question, okay? On the flip side, right, you have to deal with the question, which is, wait a second. So we paskin like Berea. You shouldn't daven for people to die. So what exactly are we doing when we do? Wait. So what? Stop that. Right? So what exactly are we doing? Right? What exactly are we doing every day, three times a day, when we say, you know, it's not exactly like V'lamal Shinim is this nice, gentle bracha. Right? I mean, I don't need to repeat it to you because you guys daven. But just for kicks. Right? Just for kicks. Let's just go, right? V'lamal Shinim, or originally V'laminim, V'lamishumadim. Okay, we won't get into it. Right? Whoever, we start off. Al Tihi, that's not clear. Yeah, Ruth Langer has written an entire book on this point of whether it's actually Christians. What? I haven't gotten my hands on it, which is very upsetting to me. Yes, it's called. One second. Cursing the Christians? A History of Birkat Haminim. Yes, it is an entire book on this point. I know, but I haven't got my hands on it. It seems good. From what I have read of it, it seems good. I think, like, whatever I could get on Google Books or something like this, I read. Anyways, but the bracha is pretty harsh, right? Vilam al shinim al tihi tikva. Right, just in case you thought, right, it was a nice bracha. There shall not be hope, right? Right? All the evil people should be lost in a moment. Right? And then we have all these nice sounding words, right? Right? They're all nice, right? Right? It's a very nice sounding bracha. It's totally in the spirit of Berea, right? Right? Yeah, we've all read it. It's all about how we should daven for them to be better people. Isn't that the bracha you all say every morning? And every what? Right. I mean, isn't that what you say? Vila malshinim tihi tikva. Let there be hope for them because they will do tshuva. That's the bracha I say. What? Right. Right. Exactly. As opposed to what we actually say. Vizchol rishak regadovei. Now, so good. Very good. So then you're going to say, no, don't worry. Maybe that bracha is mean. But what... Take a wild guess. What are some of the mafarshim going to do?
Well, you can say that.
What are they going to do? Guess. Very good, Mordechai. Of course there are going to be people who go and say, Rish'ah doesn't mean the Rishayim. Right? It means the Rishud. Now, I will point out that people definitely say that. And why do they say that? What's their proof? Berea. But I'm just going to remind you how the rest of the bracha goes out. And let's just see. I will point out it's a little bit hard in most of the bracha when you say maybe Risha means the sin and not the sinner. Last I checked, your enemies usually refers to a person rather than those uninstantiated ideals of enemy-ness or V'hazedim, and the sinners, not, right? Mehera. Now, just in case you didn't know what we're supposed to do with the Zaydim, with the sinners, Mehera ta'akeru tishaber utimager v'tachnia v'mehera v'yameinu, right? Right, so... Right, so again, so obviously, what some people are going to do is say... Now, so methodologically, tell me what you need to do. So, okay, you could be the Munkacher and say, we pop against Berea. What's the proof? Because every day we say... Kill him! Kill him! Kill him! Okay, you could do that. Good. So some people could say it depends on Jews versus non-Jews, right? If someone's comfortable with that distinction, you could see them doing it. What else? You could distinguish between different types of sins. Very good. And you could do that in different ways. And this is where we're going to come back to the Chotim Chataim, right? Because it could be, right? Because it could be. So you could distinguish between. So you could distinguish between the type of sin, right? So if you wanted to distinguish between type of sin, what types of sins would you do?
Deraisa
d'Rabbanan. You could do Deraisa d'Rabbanan. You could do murder. You could do really bad sins. Right, you could do really bad sins. You could do whatever, right? You could come up with something and say, look, there are sins for which, you know, unforgivable. Oi! Right, meaning you could distinguish between the people who... you know, are murderers and like Rachmana Litzlan. Right, yeah, exactly, right? You know, there are sins where you look at it and you're like, that's a little bit harsh. You know, it's the way how sometimes, it's the way I feel. Like, when people get really angry about, you know, right? Whatever, like really big sins, Avodah Zarah, things like that. I understand, right? You know, it's like, I understand Yeshayahu is angry because people are worshiping Avodah Zarah, right? Can you imagine the heat of Yeshayahu if he was writing, and all those terrible people who aren't back in B'chol of Yisrael? I mean, like, that's a different Yeshayahu. That's not how the book is supposed to sound. I mean, that's not how this works, right? And that's a chumrah, right? I mean, okay, whatever, we can get into machlokas there, right? But even if it was an actual aveira, like, really, I mean, do you need this? If it was, I don't know, the 66 prakim of, 66 prakim of Yeshayahu and the 48 prakim of Yechezkel, like, oi, those terrible sinners, they only wait 5.5 hours between milk and meat.
Wait
a second, right? Exactly. That's exactly my point, right? So it could be that it's between a different type of sin. But it could also be base, right? If you go, it could be, no, it's not about the type of sin. It's the frequency of sin, right? There's a difference between someone who bothers you a little bit, who doesn't. So then you try to get them to do tshuva. And if people are, right, very good. So what you're going to see is that toch kedei, in an analysis of v'lam al-shinim, you get people saying, well, okay, let's figure out, is there a limit to what Berea is saying? Is she talking about all sinners? Right, or does it depend on the sin? Does it depend on the frequency? Does it depend, right? But that's what they're doing, is they're analyzing the reality, which is we do daven, right? Now, again, some people admittedly, right, methodologically, you have three options, as you know. You can reject Berea, like the Munkacher, right? You can accept Berea and say that, and just deny that V'lam al-Shinim really means what it sounds like it's saying, right? And say, no! It means evil, which some people say. Or the Kabbalists among them say, it means, I kid you not, the klipot. It means the klipot. What? Not kipot, klipot. Oh, no, God, not the... It means the klipot. The klipot? Basically, in Lurianic Kabbalah, God's spirit came into the world and went into a vessel, which then shattered into the world, and there is hidden in this darkness a little bit of godliness, and in order to elevate the world, you have to remove the shell around the supernal light of godliness to reconstruct the godly Adam Kadmon to bring Mashiach. Was that clear? I'm sure that was very clear. Right? What? So that's the klipot. The klipot are the, like, tamei vessels from the shattered shell of Adam Kadmon, whatever, the light went into Adam Kadmon, that need to be removed from the godliness in this world to allow godliness. So, Yes. So there are some of the Kabbalists who say that's what it means. When you daven for Lamal Shinim, you don't mean the sinners, you mean the Klipa. So you could, right, basically say we totally possibly like Buria and read Lamal Shinim out, right? Or you can do the hard work of saying, listen, we have the reality of Lamal Shinim, which is clearly talking about sinners. We have the reality of Buria seeming to be the preferred method here. So let's find a nuanced view in which we explain context, we explain the sin, we explain whatever, which will help us deal with it, right? So the two major questions that I want to deal with, right? So now, just to recap what we've done, right? The first thing we did was, by Girsa work, was figure out what exactly is she doing. Is she approaching Reb Meir just as, you know, her husband and davening, or Reb Meir as the head of the Beis Din, and she's trying to solve a political crisis, right? With someone who happens to be her husband, and therefore she has tools at her advantage and maybe someone else doesn't, right? That was the first thing. Second thing was the grammatical point. What is the argument she's actually making, right? That this is the pshat, that it's a possible pshat, right? Is it sin versus constant sin? Is it there's a potential read? It's reading without the vowel, etc., right? Third point was, emotionally, psychologically, what is she doing? We suggest that all she's doing is really trying to get him out of system one to system two, right? To get him to think. And then the fourth point we did was from C.S. Lewis, which was, okay, well, what is the psychological method you can use, which is realize that in yourself you do this, right? That you're capable of saying, even if I do bad things, it's not that I don't think I'm bad. I might, right? But I still don't hate myself. Right, because I can be disappointed, right? And right. So that was the next point we did, and then we said that the two major questions, which I guess we'll come back to next week, is one is how do you daven for someone to do tshuva? Doesn't that seem to play with free will? And the second is why do we have tefillah where we do seem to daven for people to be destroyed and to die rather than just daven for them to do tshuva? And is there a way of negotiating that into Bruria's argument? Okay, so that's, we've accomplished a lot, and we have a lot more to go. I know it's a very short story, but there's a lot in this story, and it's very important. And Toch Kedei, part of why I wanted to describe, besides the fact that I love it, is that a few years ago, I was giving a weekly shiur, or tefillah shiur, on understanding the brachot, and then COVID happened, and I never got to Lamal Shinim, but I already had my shiur prepared, including all the explanations. So I was like, okay, I can at least use it now, and get you guys to both understand the story and Lamal Shinim. Josh, you get the last question, then Sam Amarov.
Can you explain this again? Say, not that Rimmer actually wanted to kill them, but he wanted to scare them into doing Shiva.
And that would assume that they, well, that if it's just davening, not. If they call
so
them to.
That
I doubt. If you read it like the Paris and Munich manuscript that he put them in Cherem and then wanted to kill them.
Like
oh, so then yes. Right? Meaning then you might read it as saying he wanted to scare them into being good by, you know, threatening to kill them. And she's like, what do you educate them? I mean, that's it. Right? That could be. Right? If you have the Munich or if you have the Munich and Paris manuscripts, I think that is a potential read. Okay? But we still have the two major questions, overarching questions about tefillah and about free will to deal with next week. What else? If we cover those and all the questions we've done today, we've done a lot. Is there more after that? Yes, but of course, but at least those two I think are very important, so we'll do that next week.